Coming up on this week's show, the Sega Saturn handheld console,
a stunning new Amiga demo,
and we go from Core Designs to Walt Disney Studios with Rolf Moore.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you every Friday with our amazing friends at Bitmap Books. Now, one of their books I'm in love with right now, The Secret History of Mac Gaming, the brand new expanded edition. Now, if you ever thought that the Mac wasn't a gaming platform and doubted its contribution to the history of video games, you need to check this book out. We'll tell you more about it in just a bit, and you can check it and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our friends at PCBWay. Now, if you're working on a retro project at the moment, give them a try. They offer a fully featured custom PCB prototype service with low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards. And they offer services like 3D printing and injection molding. And they're massive supporters of the retro community. So get an instant quote right now at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 369, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the podcast that each and every Friday takes you on a nostalgic trip back to the classic days of video games and, of course, goes inside the companies that brought those legendary titles to us back in the day with a veteran of the industry on each week's show. And of course, before that, we bring you up to speed on everything that's been happening in the world of retro gaming and tech from over the last 7 days. And I'm hoping that Ravi's not too tired. I know you are full on at the moment preparing for this massive UK Amiga event that you're putting on in how many months away is it now? Don't want to panic here or anything? Not long?
We've got a few, but I have been kind of behind the scenes just like organising this whole event, which is kind of crazy. It's going to be a big Amiga UK show, so check it out at amigashow.com. And it's going to be on the 1st and 2nd of July. And actually, we've got an announcement, which is a new guest. So at the moment, we have Mike Daly from DMA Designs coming along. We've also got Simon Phipps from Core, who was responsible for Rick Dangerous and some quite cool titles. And, you know, it's going really well, the ticket sales, and we're getting all the traders and stuff. And I'm really quite excited about this. I can't wait to actually be there and be at an Amiga event.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, we were talking when you announced it a couple of weeks ago. It's been nearly a decade since the last UK Amiga Expo, you know, like a nationwide one. And you're going to be hosting this in Nottingham at Meadow Lane Stadium on the 1st and 2nd of July. I'm looking at your website right now. It says 107 days to go. So you haven't got long left to get your tickets. I mean, I'm sure you're going to have a lot more announcements before then as well.
Oh, but, for sure.
There's also a big after party as well that's going to be happening in Nottingham.
Yeah, the after party is actually sold out at the moment because it's been so popular, that element of it. And yeah, that's going to be really good. And hopefully next year we're going to try to expand it and make it even bigger. So this is, you know, something that I want to do every single year.
Yeah, so tickets are available to buy right now on that website, amigashow.com. I know you're putting Joe to work as a car park attendant on the day.
Joe's going to be like a dancer.
I thought I was going to be a very special guest.
he's going to have to do the Amiga theme song on stage.
I will be. No, I'm going to be there. If you've got any competitions on, I'm going to be, you know, brushing up on my Amiga skills.
Being at a football stadium, we've got to get sensible soccer out.
So. Yeah, I think sensible soccer and fingers crossed some micro machines as well.
Oh, yeah, got to be done. So it's going to be massive. Make sure you join us for that. Tickets are on sale now. Get them before they sell out. Amigashow.com for Kickstart 01 happening in the UK 1st and 2nd of July. Now, we have got an amazing guest on this week's podcast as well. I mean, you mentioned Simon Phipps from Core Design. And our guest this week actually worked at Core back in the day as well and went on to some even bigger companies after that.
Yeah, so this is Rolf Moore, and Rolf has an absolutely amazing career. You know, we're based in Nottingham, so we have a Core right next to us in Derby. And Rolf actually started Games Workshop, which is a brand based in Nottingham, and then went on to Core to do some backgrounds and kind of graphics for video games like Universe and the Curse of Enchantia. You've got to say the backgrounds are stunning. They look like something out of Fantasia or one of those kind of Disney titles. Really.
You know, when I first saw that game as well, because it runs on a standard Amiga 500, and I think they used some kind of graphical trick to get more colours in there. But literally, first time I saw that, I was like, how the hell have they done this on an Amiga 500?
Yeah, it was a very impressive title. And then Rolf kind of ended up moving into many different companies, including Sony Signosis. So he tells us all about, you know, going into that kind of 3D Studio Max era, learning Silicon Graphics machines and kind of taking that step away from the 2D Amiga stuff into the 3D world. Then eventually going on to Hasbro, doing some absolutely amazing titles there as well. Trespasser, which was that Steven Spielberg Jurassic Park title as well. Touchy on the Fringe as well. There was a lot of like 3D space shooters, but then also going into the PS2 with Ratchet and Clank, doing Halo as well, Combat Evolved and the Master Chief Collection. And then later on, going all the way up to DreamWorks and Disney, becoming one of the chief concept artists there that basically helps create stuff for, you know, Tron and some of these brands like Alien that have started to come back. So this is going to be a really interesting interview.
You know, it's just incredible the amount of projects and companies that he's worked for. I wonder when Rolf ever sleeps.
Yeah, maybe.
That's quite the CV he's got.
Maybe
there,
he's
it?
Creating graphics in his sleep. That probably helps. Yeah, but it's a great kind of story of development coming from, you know, that comic book world as well. And then eventually going into the whole 3D space and then, you know, visiting some of these older brands that we all love and helping bring them back.
So an absolute superstar. Rolf Moore is going to be our guest on the show in around half an hour from now. Now, of course, before that, we like to bring you up to speed on what's been happening in the world of retro from over the last 7 days. And it seems to be a bit of a trend in retro gaming right now that fans just want to miniaturize things. We're talking about that even smaller version of the Atari Lynx a couple of weeks ago. And now, I don't want anyone laughing here, but this is a little project called the Sega Uranus.
Isn't it pronounced Uranus?
Well, this is a miniature handheld Sega Saturn
that you can have knit close to your... No.
There's always one, isn't there? Yeah, so handheld Sega Saturn. My dreams are coming true, somewhat anyway. So this is... obviously, this isn't Sega putting it to mass production or anything like this. This is a prototype that's been made by a user called TZMWX. And this isn't actually the first time he's done something like this, but it's the first time it seems to have kind of like been picked up and got any sort of like, you know, kind of notoriety on the...
Notoriety.
Notoriety. So they're saying, it's funny, in the articles I've been reading about it, people go, oh, it looks just like a Game Gear. So it's about the same size as Game Gear. But if you actually read into it, I thought it looks more like the Sega Nomad. And then reading into it, it's actually based on the Sega Venus prototype, which I believe we covered on the show a couple of years ago, which was kind of like dug up by Sega about 2 or 3 years ago. But yeah, imagine if you know the Nomad, if you don't, it's about the same size as the Game Gear. And then it's kind of got, you know, the 6 buttons on the left, on the right-hand side and the D-pad on the right-hand side. I really like the look of it. It's based on the Japanese Sega Saturn, so it's that kind of like white plastic kind of, not chrome, but like a matte kind of white plastic. I really like the look of. He's got a video out at the moment with him, you know, not much kind of like, well, there isn't really any talking in it, but kind of showing it off. And he's got it not just playing Sega Saturn on there, but he's also got playing the video CD off the on it as well. You know what Sega Saturn could play with the, you know.
Or the FMV card.
The FMV card. He's got that working on it as well. So obviously he's done away with the disk drive on it, because obviously you can't have a big chunky CD kind of drive on the back of it and moving it around and stuff like that. It's just going to fall out of place and scratch and stuff. So it is running off SD card. So, you know, some people could argue, oh, it's just a Raspberry Pi now or anything and stuff like that. But it isn't. It is running off a Sega Saturn motherboard, which is taken apart and has got, you know, working in there. So it is original Sega Saturn hardware in there. It has just got an SD card loader to emulate the games on it.
He's also got the cart in there as well, which is the 4 meg expansion.
Yeah, the 4 meg expansion card.
Which is pretty useful to have in there.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you can use, there's a lot of games that, you know, required that or were enhanced with it. A lot of the King of Fighter games and like Samurai Showdown games and stuff like that. A lot of like the Japanese fighters, which I think is really cool. Obviously, he's got, you know, a nice like 3.5-inch display on the LCD display. And then a battery life of 3 hours. So a little bit better than the Game Gear, I would say. I love this. I love the look of this. I think it's really nice size.
It's interesting. It's got like some brightness controls and stuff like that. And like these are thought out devices. You know, we've covered this guy before. And TZMWX. And they're really nice devices. But for me, this needs to be in black. Like seeing it in white is a bit weird. Yeah. Like the PlayStation 1, I kind of get. But maybe he hasn't got any black filament on his 3D printer.
Well, if he's trying to make it look like the Venus, I mean, the Venus was white, wasn't it? White and grey. Yeah. He's kind of basing it on that look.
I don't know if he's based it on the Japanese Sega Saturn. So the Japanese Sega Saturn was white.
Oh, okay. I don't think I've seen one of those.
Yeah, that was white.
They look weird when you see them, but they're quite slick looking.
They look more like the Dream, like they're the kind of same colour as the Dreamcast. So it always throws me off when I see a Japanese Sega Saturn, because like say Ravi, we're so used to seeing them in black, and I think in black there was something about like the Mega Drive and the Sega Saturn which looked like really futuristic, but what the 90s looked like in the future. So I think I'll have to agree with you. I see why he's done it in white, but I prefer it in black as well.
Yeah, it's well impressive though. This is like, you know, as close as you're going to get to a commercial product having the original hardware in there is just totally nuts. And it's like you can see the progression of his design as well. You know, he's got stuff like there's like a bevel or kind of indent around the D-pad, you know, so you're going to be comfortable whilst playing it. It seems to have a nice kind of curvature to the case, which is really cool, and like the LEDs and then all the relevant plugs and stuff. Like I've made an Amiga laptop out of Lego. It's no way as slick and beautiful as this. This is a really well thought out
Lego laptop.
Ergonomic kind of design, you know.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I have seen other projects, you know, people miniaturizing the Saturn into a handheld, but none of them look quite as slick as this. I mean, there are, yeah, like you said in the video, if you watch it, and also this article that I'll link up on Retro Dodo, they kind of go through a few iterations of it. I mean, the original one's just kind of that 3D printed resin. But by the time it gets further into the prototype, I mean, you've got different coloured buttons on there. It's even got the Sega Saturn logo under the screen as well. So it does look like, I mean, it could be a commercial product. And I love seeing stuff like this as well, because, I mean, to me, even seeing like the Game Gear back in the day, how much more powerful that was than the Game Boy, for example, you know, being colour and, you know, it just felt like it was basically a television console in a handheld format. Something like the Sega Saturn just felt far too powerful and power hungry, I suppose, you know, to shrink down into a handheld form factor. So in a way, it kind of proves how far we've come in terms of battery technology. I mean, can you imagine doing something like this using 90s components on like 6 AA batteries? You probably get about 5 minutes battery life out of it back then.
About 5 minutes battery life. And then obviously you probably have to have some sort of massive disc drive on the back, you know, something maybe reminiscent of the PSP where it kind of holds it in place, you know, like there is a, you know, the UMD disc, but obviously the size of a normal CD. So it would have been pretty chunky, but I would have loved that as well.
Yeah. I mean, it is great to see so many fan projects coming along, and I just want all of these handheld systems that are coming out, but it's like, you know, I work from home all the time now. I need to go out more, Joe. This is making me realise. So if you want to check out more about this, I'll link it up in our show notes, along with all of the stories in your podcast app or at theretrohour.com. Now, speaking of trends in retro gaming at the moment, it is Survival Horror Game of the Week, Joe. We've covered this pretty much every week over the last month or two since we knew on all the time. Maybe because you're a big fan of them and you keep an eye out. But this one, I've got to say, does look very impressive. Now, this is a new game called Rewind or Die that is kind of inspired by like PlayStation 1 style graphics.
Yeah, so, you know, I don't know who keeps finding these stories, you know, who keeps trawling through these horror game forums. These
mystery games.
It's a complete mystery. But yeah, this is Rewind or Die, which is going to be coming out on Steam on April 14th. So we got a trailer a couple of days ago for this. And this is PlayStation 1 inspired graphics. I don't know about you guys, but I love the look of this game. And I've played a couple of these games.
To me, it looks a bit more like a Sega Saturn, actually.
It's definitely got a Sega Saturn look to it as well. Very reminiscent of like Silent Hill, more so than kind of like Resident Evil. But this is going to be published by a company called Torture Star Video, who are a part of, they're like a subsidiary of a publisher called Puppet Combo. And what they do is they do, so Puppet Combo are kind of renowned for doing this kind of like horror VHS style slasher games that they've been doing. I played Murder House last year for Xbox Series X, which absolutely terrified me. That was like a fixed camera, you know, isometrical view like Resident Evil, whereas this is a first person view. And what I think is quite cool about this is it's set in the 80s, as they all are, but you work in a movie shop. So it's set, you know, a video store, like a Blockbuster, and you work as like the clerk on the night shift, you know, and it starts off like pretty simple, kind of like serving customers and going through the dialogues and stuff. And it's a first person perspective, and, you know, you pick what you want to say and stuff like that. But then what happens is overnight is you get attacked by a serial killer, as you do, you know, and the game takes an absolute massive turn and becomes a little bit of a survival horror first person shooter. And like I say, I've played a couple of these games by Puppet Combo, and Torture Star Video seems to be the new kind of like subsidiary they're going with. And yeah, these games, I've recently played through like Callisto Protocol, which is a brand new horror game, and the Dead Space remake and stuff like that, and they don't really scare me, whereas these old PS1 style games, there's something about them that's really unsettling and just really make me jump out of my skin. Maybe it's the music, maybe it's just like the janky graphics and, you know, janky controls, but there's something about it I absolutely love.
You know what would make it? This would make a really good virtual reality game as well, I think, looking at the trailer.
Yeah, it would actually. Yeah,
it could work. It's first person kind of perspective a lot of it, isn't it? Although there's one thing I'm reading here, and there's someone in the comments on this website, bloody-disgusting.com. There's a little quote in here that said, "It turns the mundane job of a video rental store clerk on its head." And the first comment is, "You mean dream job?" Now, I don't know about you guys. I always fancied working in Blockbuster when I was a teenager. I always thought that was like an amazing job.
My friend worked in Blockbuster. he ended up getting like just a lot of popcorn, a lot of chocolates and stuff on discount, and it wasn't the healthiest kind of job. I think it just like absolutely caned him. He'd like come home with a big bottle of Dr. Pepper every week, you know.
Because I remember being about 13 and going into my local Blockbuster, and then there was it's the guy in there, like, you know, maybe a Sunday afternoon, he was just watching a movie, and I think he had like a, you know, one of the fresh Cokes and a popcorn as well. I remember looking at him thinking, God, I'd love to do that job one day. This looks really cozy.
What a job. You soon get bored of it. I've actually got a friend at work, we're going off on one here, but he used to work at the Golden Wonder Factory as a taste tester, like a quality control tester, and used to have to eat the crisps off the conveyor belt hot. And he said, you know, when he first got the job, it was his dream job, and after 2 days, he was sick of crisps.
I think I could do that, Joe. I don't think I'd ever get bored of crisps.
This video looks all right, this kind of rewind or die. It's interesting because they've got this kind of old school effect over it, which is this blur and stuff. And I'm not quite sure I like it. Like, I'd rather see clarity, but with like no anti-aliasing, or like, you know, when you had a bit of jagginess with it, and this seems to kind of remove that jagginess for me.
You can switch it off in the games I've played by these guys before, so obviously.
Oh, okay, yeah. But, I'd prefer to go in that mode.
Yeah,
it seems a bit like the N64 Vaseline kind of.
Yeah, I think that is the idea of it. You know, Silent Hill for the PS1 had that, you know, that Vaseline draw distance, like fog that you say, but you can switch it off. You do have the fog, the draw distance still, but that, like, that smear effect that you're talking about. Obviously, I can't say it will be in this one, but in, I think I've played two of them, and the two I've played, that you could switch it off, and I switched it off. I'm not going to lie, I switched it off.
Is it meant to be like a CRT filter?
Yeah, it's kind of like it's a CRT filter, and it's kind of like to help with the draw distance and stuff to kind of make it like that retro feel, like, you know, like Ravi's N64 ones.
It's interesting, like, that was one element that we would live in fear of when you would rent a movie. It was always rent it, but return it on time because you're going to get charged extra and make sure it's rewound. That was always one thing that I'd always get told off when you get it. Right, when you get this one, make sure it comes on time. And it was like, it's quite a big charge as well that you used to get on top of the movie, you know.
If you'd looked inside Blockbuster and there was a serial killer in there, they might have let you off the fine.
It might have been.
Probably not known Blockbuster, to be fair. So it does look really good, this game, though, coming out on Steam in about a month from now. Looks like there is a wish list of it already, so I'll link that up in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, you mentioned not being a fan of the N64 smear Vaseline effect, Ravi. This one might be for you. This is a new Raspberry Pi Pico-powered adapter that gives the good old N64 a very sharp-looking HDMI video output.
This is, like, this to me is just, it's going to break the whole market of, you know, external converters and stuff. Because if people can do this with a Pico, which is, you know, an incredibly cheap device, and it can be applied to other machines. You know, I'm looking here at the moment. You can get one from Pi Hut for £3.60.
It's like a chip, isn't it? Really small Raspberry.
Yeah, but yeah, yeah, programmable chip, basically. But if you can have this connected to any machine, and you can start to use this as a way of getting an output on a video. You know, we've seen with the Amiga, they've used RGB ones at the moment, which are like RGB Pis that are basically converting the signal. And this is great because it's making it a lot cheaper for people to run their machines. It's very bare wires at the moment, kind of hanging out of the machine and stuff. But I can imagine the more this design gets slicker and, you know, people print like little 3D printed cases and stuff like this, this could be applied to lots of different systems. And then, you know, that whole buying a FrameMeister for lots of money would kind of just go really and be for like the complete pros, or, you know, buying one of these like really high-end converters. If you can do this with a Pico, wow, it's just something that could be just insanely cheap.
Well, this is a guy called Conrad Beckmann. He was a guy, we actually spoke about his other Pico project on the show a while ago, maybe last year. He did the Pico Kart 64.
Yeah.
That was emulates a cartridge. But this is actually based on another project. He's kind of took it to the next level. And I mean, you can follow his progress on Twitter, where he's kind of showing the development of this. It looks like there is quite a lot of input lag right now, but I guess he's kind of running this in some kind of debug mode. And I imagine it'll look a lot better.
Yeah, it's as these things develop, you know, they get better and better, and more people kind of get involved, you know.
It does seem like, though, the amount of Raspberry Pis that are suddenly cropping up inside retro systems. I think it was your last Amiga meeting I came to, the Robin Hood group. I think there was one guy there who had he had a Raspberry Pi taking care of an HDMI output on an Amiga 500, then another Raspberry Pi taking over the CPU. There's at least two of them in there doing different jobs. But like you said, I mean, they're just so much cheaper than custom projects, aren't they, and making your own boards and that kind of
thing. Yeah, and you know, this could become a thing, you know, you just buy your Pico converter board, you just plug it in and then sorted. You can just go and you can, you know, go around Joe's house and get every single machine that's on RF and just like
I knew that was
convert it up for like 30 quid or something, you know.
I was thinking to myself, you guys are going to say, what do you think of this, Joe? And I was going to say, you know what I'm like, you know, with my RF cables.
Yeah, Joe is a guy, we went to his house for the first time when he had his setup, it was going back a while now. When did you move into that house?
7 years ago.
Seven years ago. Yeah, we checked the back of your telly, everything. Well, I think we're playing some consoles, Joe's like, I've got to retune the TV. We're like, hang on a minute, are you watching these via RF on a LCD?
I love the kind of line that he said here, you know, he says a proper kit might show up later. You know, they're aiming for a no-cut solution as well, which would be, you know, having to get in there or do any soldering or anything like that,
which will be nice. Yeah. I mean, Joe's kind of gone the other route. You went down the CRT route in the end, which, to be fair, I mean, the N64 is a weird console to me. I've never seen one obviously upscaled like this. I mean, I've seen people kind of plugging them into LCDs via, you know, the composite cables, which just looks horrendous. You know, when it's like really blurry and upscaled, it is probably the worst console to upscale onto a modern TV, I think, generally, you know, in terms of just plugging it straight in.
Yeah.
But having something like this, I mean, might make it look a hell of a lot better. But for me, it's like, that is the one system. If you said you need a CRT for the N64, that's kind of the one that jumps out for me.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's taking that raw digital signal and then kind of converting it to a HDMI one, which is seems to be the way to do it. I do remember when there was all these HDMI RGB mods, and people would go in and kind of physically do it. And I guess the Pico is actually doing that signal conversion where before they could, you know, chuck it out in the RGB, but they'd have to have a way of displaying that and not getting that HDMI compatibility.
Yeah, it does make it a lot better though, because like you said, you're tapping straight into the video signal rather than trying to go via the outputs that are already there, which I imagine was a big problem with the N64, that the video output just wasn't all that great to begin with, you know, the ports that we had on there. But yeah, I mean, it looks like a great solution, because that's the thing. I mean, not everyone's got room for a CRT, and plugging these in, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but my TV's about 5 years old, maybe. It hasn't got any SCART sockets on there, nothing like that. So there's very few ways to kind of get an analog signal into a modern TV these days. So if you want to play the original consoles and you haven't got an old school television, you haven't really got much choice, really, if you want to go down the HDMI route, which a lot of televisions, you know, only have that as their modern input. So, yeah, it is very cool to see. So if you want to follow the project of the progress of that project, I'll link that up in our show notes as well. Now, this is an interesting one. I've got to say, when Joe and I first saw this, Ravi, our jaws absolutely dropped at this demo. But you've been looking a bit more into this. Now, this is something that I've seen absolutely everywhere. I've had people tag me on Twitter, a bunch of people in our Discord. I know Gareth posted it in Discord as well, as did Ash as well. And this has been all over the Amiga forums and the Facebook groups. This is a new 3D engine, apparently for the Amiga 1200, that they're calling a Spyro the Dragon tech demo. Basically saying that Spyro the Dragon could technically run on an Amiga 1200.
Yeah, kind of. It's impressive as hell, this is. This is a really, really nice kind of 3D engine that's getting developed. And it's using a couple of advantages that are on the Amiga. So you've got the ham mode, which is hold and modify. So it's running in ham 6. And the ham mode was always interesting to see games and demos produced in there. There's a certain look with ham mode where it's got a bit of blur and kind of, you know, the graphics, they're not always the sharpest and stuff, but
you normally get the colors kind of fringing at the edge, don't you?
Yeah, but I'm kind of really nostalgic for that. I kind of think it's got its own beauty as well. And ham was always used for speeding up video stuff. And there's also chunky to planar as well, which is a routine. And combining those together seems to have created this absolutely fantastic engine. It is running really well. Some of the demos that we've seen, you know, this is based on Dread, which is one of the games that came out for the Amiga recently, which was kind of using a lot of these effects that were created, a lot of these routines as well, to create an amazing Doom experience, you know, Doom-like experience.
It was like a Doom clone that could run on like an Amiga 500, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And and this can run on an Amiga. Now, the thing is, they're running different kind of graphics within there. So there's been an example of kind of Descent-style engine that's running in there. So, you know, the game Descent for the PC, where you're kind of floating through corridors and stuff, and that works really well, and that runs on the original Amiga, and this is on the O20 processor, and you will have to have some fast RAM. So the fast RAM actually affects the way that it's displayed. So, you know, obviously more fast RAM, the better it's going to be. Now,
I remember in Amiga 500, you put some fast RAM in, that speeds it up by about 4 or 5 times anyway, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And the impressive thing about this is it's running on such a low spec. Now, the difference is the demo that we're seeing is probably running an emulator, I'm going to say, because the chip RAM would not be able to handle that kind of that Spyro. You know, whole world, it's all got to get loaded into 2 megabytes.
Because it's running at 50 frames a second in this demo.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And, you know, they're saying actually the performance is going to be 20% less than that demo that we're looking at. But still, that's very impressive,
yeah.
You know, to be running at that speed. And this is like something that's just started, this engine. So, you know, this engine could get refined more and more. And you need to think about, like, models of games that could start to get put in there. And also there may be tricks, I'm not sure, using like map ROM features, or there may be tricks using different speed ups and stuff to be able to have maybe more powerful CPUs in there that can handle more in there and, you know, run it at some crazy speeds. I'm just trying to think of what kind of titles you think they could implement in this engine.
Spyro the Dragon. It would be the obvious choice for me. But you're right, because I mean, there's a guy who made this. He's called RST7 is his name. And I've been reading some of the discussions on GitHub and on English Amiga Board as well. And he's basically saying this is a small 3D engine for the Amiga, but he hasn't really got the skills to implement a game in there.
Yeah.
So what he's looking is for kind of other people who are maybe game designers.
It's kind of like a demo, isn't it? Like,
yeah, yeah. I mean, it's an engine demo, really, isn't it? And there are some people who've posted videos of it running on real Amiga hardware. I mean, there's a very blurry handheld demo video on YouTube that's unlisted, but I'll put a link to this in our show notes as well. Of someone running it on an Amiga 4000, and it doesn't look quite as smooth as in this video. Yeah. But it is still very impressive for what it's doing. And like you said, I mean, it's early days of this as well. I'm sure there are more optimizations.
At the moment, it's RST7 and CBCIE. And they seem to be the folks behind it. It looks well impressive, yeah. And I'm thinking, like, there was a game, do you remember it? It was called Tales from Heaven,
yeah.
Which was kind of in this effect. It was like a platformer. It was done in that kind of hand mode graphics. But to me, that seemed like kind of N64-y kind of PlayStation graphics, which this is getting onto the edge of. Obviously, that needed like an 040 and it needed some proper kick and it needed to
get... And even that run pretty slow from what I remember.
Yeah, and you never, in HAM, you're never going to get that like definition that they had. But like I said, it's got its own beauty and it's got its own kind of look. What do you think, Joe, coming from a kind of a console world and seeing this done, considering that the machine has a graphics chip, but it doesn't have a huge like graphics card in there or anything?
You know what it reminds me of? But I'm in my mind's eye here because I've not played this very much. Magic Carpet. Do you remember that for the PS1?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, it proper reminds me of
that.
If
you're talking about Blur Vision and Mist.
yeah. With the Blur Vision and the Mist. And then just the style of what they're trying to do as well, also kind of like that floating around and stuff, reminds me of Forsaken, but which is another kind of PlayStation 1 era game. But I just, yeah, you can tell it's Spyro, like looking at it and stuff like that. But you, like Ravi says, like, I know it's probably a little bit too good to be true, but it's still in concept. I think it's very cool.
No, and I think they can get there, you know what I mean, with these optimizations. But I also think there's a certain look to HAM as well that you might not have seen, which it kind of feels a bit less than Sega Saturn-y in, like, you know, definition, because it hasn't got the polygons and stuff. But, I just love the HAM look.
And I think as well, the fact that, you know, everyone now seems to be getting like Pi Storms and stuff in their Amigas, I guess, you know, no one really has to make games for a standard 1 megabyte Amiga 500 anymore.
Yeah.
You can do a bit more with it now, which I think is very cool. Now these solutions are becoming affordable. So, yeah, it looks really impressive. And for anyone who's got the skills to make this into a full game, I'll link up the discussions on EAB and his GitHub as well, because I know he's looking for people to give him a hand with that. It does look like a very impressive engine to get started on.
I think the more people involved with it, the better it will grow, and, you know, get the other programmers involved, get some ideas of, like, you know, maps that they want to put in there and stuff, and then you've got this crazy engine as well as this crazy Doom clone.
So I'll stick that so far. You can check out the video and the GitHub as well if you want to download it and give it a try, in the show notes and at theretrohour.com. Now, if we're talking about impressive games as well, now F-Zero back in the day, obviously, legendary game, and it looks like there have been a few kind of spiritual successors to it that we've talked about over the last 6 months or so, and this one looks very cool. Now, this is called XF Extreme Formula.
Yeah, so it does feel a little bit like a lot of these indie developers are trying to, you know, fill the void of our F-Zero-less world. We've not had, correct me if I'm wrong, an F-Zero game since the GameCube with F-Zero GX, which, you know, in my head is probably like, oh yeah, that was only a couple of years ago, but probably getting on for 20 years, I imagine, probably about 19 years ago now, I think that came out. And, you know, F-Zero, I kind of had to remind myself when I was looking at this, F-Zero is it's not like a, you know, a game made by Capcom and Nintendo. It's always been on Nintendo consoles. It's a Nintendo game, you know, like, I forget. It's a, you know, a fully, you know, first party Nintendo.
It was Miyamoto
game,
wasn't it?
It's Miyamoto, and it was a, you know, yeah. I think it was a release game on the SNES, or at least a very, very early game on the Super Nintendo, and then obviously N64 and GameCube, and it does feel really strange that we've not had a Wii U or Switch, you know, F-Zero, or at least a remaster of GX for the GameCube, because that had absolutely stunning graphics. But as you say, we're covering a lot of these games that are trying to fill that void. And, you know, how close can you get to something before Nintendo come for you? You know, we're looking at this XF Extreme. So it's being advertised kind of like as a spiritual successor to F-Zero. At a glance, it just looks like F-Zero to me. You know, it's got this, you know, the ships. I don't want to call them spaceships, but, you know, the cars, if you will, the hover cars. It's got the crazy tracks. It's got the futuristic look to it. It's got the cars going over 1,000 miles an hour.
It looks quick. The speed it on looks, it it's, looks quite
it,
exhilarating.
It looks very, very quick. It's coming to Steam. It's, you know, in early stages at the moment, but runs at 60 frames per second with 30 cars on the track as well. So very similar to F-Zero. And it's being produced by one guy, being made by one guy called Philippe Ribeiro Danlos, I think, of Fepid Games. I think this looks really cool. You know, I've wrote in my notes here, like, Nintendo kind of need to get themselves into gear if they want to be, you know, like, you know, kind of fill this void. But I'm also worried Nintendo might come after him as they do. But I think this looks stunning. I think this looks absolutely stunning. But it's got kind of like a, I don't know if you guys agree, like a cel-shaded graphic style to it as well.
Graphically, weirdly, it reminds me of Outrun 2006.
Horizon Chase Turbo, which was the kind of one done recently. It reminds me of that.
Yeah, I mean, it looks really nice. And, you know, I love a good racing game. And I've got to say, in terms of speed, especially when you get like the turbo boost and stuff as well, it looks like one of the... actually, in some ways, you know, in terms of the speed boost and stuff, it reminds me a little bit of like something like Sonic and Sega All-Star Racing. There's a bit of that kind of element there as well.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Kind of the style of the backgrounds and stuff now you've said it, I can see that.
Yeah, I mean, it does look really, it looks right up my alley. I've always loved these games as well. You know, I love the original F-Zero. I remember playing that at my friend's house on his Super Nintendo. And I think it was one of the first SNES games that used Mode 7 back in the day as well, wasn't it?
I think it was. Yeah, so Pilot Wings. They either came out with the SNES or Pilot Wings came out just before F-Zero. But yeah, it was definitely one of the first.
Yeah, and I'm hoping this sells well as well, because it does kind of prove that, you know, that will prove there's an appetite for this kind of game out there too.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Which, like you said, I mean, I've just checked. Wait, yeah, the last Nintendo F-Zero game was 2004.
Oh, I was right.
So, yeah, 19 years ago, you're right. So, yeah, that was F-Zero Climax that came out on the GameCube. So long overdue. So if you've been desperately waiting for a new F-Zero game, this looks really good, coming out on Steam very soon. It would be great if it got like a Switch release or something, but... Not holding my breath on that one, but you never know. Stranger things have happened. So I'll put that in our show notes as well. And all the other stories, you find them all at theretrohour.com. I can't believe how quickly this month is flying by, more than halfway through the month already. That means next weekend, next Sunday night, is going to be our favourite weekend of the month. Last Sunday of the month just feels like Christmas every month, doesn't it?
if you mean wearing silly jumpers, getting drunk, being nostalgic and spending money, then absolutely, yes. That's spot on for me.
Well, this is, of course, our patrons hangout. Now, we do this last Sunday of every month in the evening from 8 p.m. UK time for a couple of hours. When we all get together, as many of our patrons that want to come on, join us, we all geek out about all things retro gaming, show off our collection, share tips, help each other out if we've got problems with our hardware, nerd about movies, mobile phones, everything. No holds barred on the Patrons Hangout. And if you'd like to join us for this month, it is coming up next Sunday. And of course, it does mean that we're getting ready to record another episode of our patrons-only podcast, The Retro Hour After Hours. Now, I think we've got like, what is it, 32 episodes of that we've done now?
32, so this will be episode 33. We're always welcome to suggestions to what we talk about on the After Hours as well. So the After Hours is just the three of us. And, you know, we kind of give our opinions. We've covered a lot of, like, we used to call it the retro years. We used to cover a lot of, like, you know, what was going on in retro in that particular year. So we kind of covered all of the 90s and the early 2000s, dabbled a little bit in the 80s. We give a lot of our opinions on, like, you know, our favorite kind of Sega Mega Drive games and Super Nintendo games. And one I really loved, which was the latest episode, was our top five hidden gems. And you guys blew me away. You know, Ravi started off with a couple. I was like, I've heard of that. But about halfway through it, I hadn't heard of any of these games. And they all look really, really fantastic.
Really prove what hipsters we are.
Oh, yeah, episode, absolutely.
So if you want to check that out, I mean, that is available to all of our patrons, gold members and above. If you join us on Patreon now, you're going to unlock all 32 episodes. So plenty of listening there. And you get the normal podcast early when I can get it out some weeks. You also get it ad-free every week. And also we give you around 50 minutes. Three extra news stories that we're going to be doing just for our patrons in a minute, including some really good stuff on the EverDrive and a Windows pinball game that you might be familiar with. So if you want to join us on Patreon, you get all of that. And of course, some main reason that you're doing it is just to support this podcast and make sure that we can keep bringing it out every single week. And we've actually got some new patrons to welcome into the Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame!
So a massive thank you for joining us over the last week, Anthony Okerson,
Les Orchard,
and Rowan Allard,
who all joined us on Patreon recently. And if you'd like to join them on there, all the details to sign up to our Patreon are on our website right now at theretrohour.com. Now, before we chat to this week's special guest, Rolf Moore, who's coming up in just a second, let's take a moment to give a massive thank you to our main sponsor. And again, you know, we talk about people that we couldn't do the podcast without. That is our friends at Bitmap Books, who've sponsored this show for many years now. We love Sam and the team over there. They do incredible work. And, you know, if you're talking quality retro gaming books, they do not come much better than these, do they?
Oh, you know, I've got quite a few Bitmap books at home, and I look at them on the shelf, and they're just stunning. Like, with the sleeves and just the quality of the books, you know, some of the artwork absolutely stands out. And they've got a really interesting book at the moment, which is called The Secret History of Mac Gaming. And, you know, Mac is like a system that we don't really think about with gaming, you know. But there's a lot of gaming, a lot of developments. And I love my strategy games. There's a lot of strategy titles as well that came out on the Mac.
Well, you've got an old 68K Mac.
Yeah.
You got hold of recently, haven't you? Whenever we were to do the patrons hangout, everyone's always interested in, what's that behind you there, Ravi? You know, you're kind of working on getting a SCSI card and stuff in there as well, so you can play some old school Mac gaming. But, I mean, there are so many franchises that started on the Mac. I mean, you know, you've got Myst.
Yeah.
It was a HyperCard game, Myst, wasn't it, originally on the Mac?
Yeah, Myst. You've got SimCity. You've got Halo as well. So there's, you know, a whole group of absolutely amazing titles, and not to mention the PD stuff that was on there as well, and shareware.
We actually had Richard Moss, the author of this book, on the podcast a year or two back, didn't we? And it was a really interesting chat. So definitely worth checking out that episode that we did. And if you haven't got hold of the book yet, there is a brand new expanded edition. There's around 80 interviews in this as well with legends of the Mac gaming scene, 480 pages long. And like all of Bitmap Books books, eye-catching color pages, hardback cover as well. You know, the images in these books just leap off the pages. And this new edition has got an extra 70 pages of content. And even, you know, chatting to people like Seventh Guest co-creator and id Software legends and as well. Graham Devine, who worked for Apple back in the day. And really, if you know, you want to hear the definitive history of Mac gaming and some of the absolute icons who made games on that platform possible, have a look at that right now. You can order it. And all of their retro gaming books on the website bitmapbooks.com. Okay, next, going to be going inside the world of companies like Core Design, Walt Disney Studios, and so much more as well with our special guest Rolf Moore. He's coming up next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's special guest. Going to be covering so many incredible games and companies over the next hour or so as well, from like Core Designs to Sony Signosis to Disney as well, and lots more as well, with our special guest this week, Rolf Moore. How's it going, Rolf?
It's going good. Thank you for having me on.
Really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us now. I'm really excited to talk to you about particularly time at Core Design that we'll start with in a moment as well. Because, I mean, I loved some of the games you worked on at Core. But, I mean, before we kind of get into that, I mean, it's always kind of nice to get a bit of background on where your journey started. I mean, do you remember what initially got you into video games then? Where did it all begin for you?
I think, you know, this is such a long time ago when video games impinged on my consciousness. It's really kind of hard to tell now. There were super early games in the arcades and so on. So I think one that impacted me most was the Star Wars arcade game with its really cool vector graphics. And of course, there were earlier indications that there were video games. I had friends who had the old Atari sports games, which were just glorified versions of Pong, incredibly basic, that you plug in the telly and play them. So I think they were the first kinds of games I was aware of, but I was also fairly early on getting aware of the concept of computer graphics in general, which made me very excited. So yeah, I've only had dim recollections. I'd say the arcade games impressed me most, Star Wars and Tron in the arcade. And of course the Space Invaders and so on, which were fun and addictive, but not impressive in the way that the vector graphics were, I think.
Well, talking of Star Wars and Tron as well, were you impressed by the film effects? And
Totally blown away. It was sort of, like so many people, it was life transforming. It completely set my career path in a way, like many people. And we'll mention that in some of the games I worked on in a bit, for sure. It's hugely influential.
Yeah. Well, what was the first kind of home machine that you got and you started, you know, playing with, and were you doing art on there as well?
Oh, well, I got, my first one was a ZX81.
Which not was, too much art on a ZX81.
No, you guessed right. No, I did not manage to do any art on that one. I think what impressed me most was just the packaging, because they had these gorgeous artwork covers done by John Harris, who turned out to be one of the most sort of admired sci-fi illustrators from that period. He's now still got this kind of cult following, but he was completely unknown at the time. And he painted these gorgeous sort of epic views of these gigantic sort of tower structures that were sort of vague, sort of hard to work out what they were. And then these tiny little ships on top of these gigantic almost blocks of ice, almost sort of ahead of his time, like that they evoke the imagery of sort of cyberpunk, of these towers of black ice in these imagery. And that's actually what affected me most, more than the computer itself.
Because I know you started working as a freelance illustrator, that's and I right. mean, you know, you're working for Dark Horse Comics as well. You're working on massive, famous sci-fi titles like Aliens and Star Wars as well. So tell us a bit about that and how your journey took you there and what that was like working on those massive franchises.
Well, those came along a bit later. In my early career, I was sort of torn between trying to become a designer. My dad encouraged me to get a degree in architecture, which I sort of, you know, I agreed to sort of slightly reluctantly, because I was more interested in science fiction and filmmaking and illustration. So while I was doing my degree, I was still pursuing a career as an illustrator. So I was working on these those early paintings, such as The Colossus, which is still probably my best picture I've ever done to this day. And I submitted a bunch of samples to an agency in London. An interesting connection back to John Harris. He was with an agency called Young Artists Agency, and I tried to get in there, but I couldn't. So I was submitting to book publishers, and they referred to me to an agency called Sarah Brown Agency, and they liked my samples and asked me to do a few more. And one of the samples I did was actually a sort of a commission for a friend at university, and the publishers, Galanx, were doing a reprint of Arthur C. Clarke collection of short stories, Reach for Tomorrow, and they liked that image, so they optioned it, as it were, as a second rights deal. So they published a book with my art on it. So that was my first kind of famous claim to fame. Wow, you know, that was a lifelong sort of dream, was anything in the realm of science fiction, let alone Arthur C. Clarke, who was my probably number one favorite author, along with Asimov. And so that was kind of a trip to see my cover on an Arthur C. Clarke book, especially so early in my career. And, I really struggled, to be honest, that the illustration field was dying at that time. So I jumped in right at the wrong moment. And there were about five top sci-fi illustrators who completely cornered the market. And they were all brilliant. I couldn't really compete with them. And at the same time, I was looking around for freelance jobs, but the comic, I'd always been into comics. That's kind of how I initially learned to draw, apart from copying dinosaurs and stuff like that, which I always loved since I was 3 years old. I was into dinosaurs, but yeah, then I got into Spider-Man and Marvel comics, and so I did manage to connect with a few people to do some covers, and that I think I got the connection through going to the comic convention in London and met people like Pat Mills, who was a co-creator of 2000 AD. And through that, I got connected to some people at Dark Horse UK, who for a short while were doing reprints of the Dark Horse comics in Britain. And I also ran into Chris Cunningham, who's more known for sort of film directing videos, but he's got his start as an artist and effects guy. And he did a few Dark Horse covers for Aliens as well. And I ended up going to his flat, and he was showing me what he was working on the early version of what became AI, that Spielberg did, but Kubrick was working on it for years before.
Oh,
and
wow.
Chris Cunningham was designing and modeling maquettes for robots and humans and stuff. And he had a little baby, a sculpt of a baby's head in his flat, and with part of its head gouged out. Like, that was where you're going to see the robotics of the boy, the robot boy. Yes. And I said, oh, is that a life scan? And no, he had just a little Polaroid photo on his easel that he was working from. And it was so lifelike. He is super talented.
Yeah, he did the Aphex Twin video.
That's right. And he was working on that stuff when I was there. Okay, this is going to sound really pretentious of me, but he was working on a really early music video. And I said, you know what? The way you've done it, you haven't really edited it to time to the music very well. And the thing is that when he became famous, that was his main thing that he was known for. He did such tightly edited to the music, to the beats. And it was like, oh, maybe he listened to me. So maybe I'm taking too much credit for that. But I think that's really funny. We're diverging a lot here.
Oh no, it's all good stuff. You were moved into Games Workshop, which was that kind of like transition into the gaming world. It's tabletop as well, but like fantasy and sci-fi and stuff. What was it like working at Games Workshop or working with
them? Well, I only worked very briefly for them. I initially did some illustrations. I can't remember how I connected with them, but I was living in Nottingham at the time because that's where I went to university.
Where we're recording, yep.
Yeah, so I lived in Nottingham for 10 years, and that's my connection with you guys. And here's a funny thing. For a while, I was unemployed, literally on the dole, and I would walk along the street where Games Workshop were located. So I'd walk past them on the way to the dole office to pick up my gyro for a while. So I don't think I just knocked on their door. I just can't remember how I reached out to them. But I ended up getting to meet John Blanche, the art director, and Jez Goodwin, who designed the Eldar, who's a really talented sculptor. And they basically liked my portfolio and got me to do a few black and white illustrations initially for White Dwarf magazine. And then at some point I worked in-house for 2 weeks only, again, just freelancing on some of the buildings that were in the game. So they had those little sort of cardboard with plastic tops, and I was illustrating the actual building facades that would wrap around the buildings. And I ended up doing a cover for Space Fleet, which was actually a hybrid. Fangorn, who was their most famous illustrator, had already done a version, but they didn't like the view through the porthole to the actual space battle. So I redid the Imperials versus Eldar space battle as the main scene that was seen through the porthole. And in a way, none of this was really a transition. It was the... You know, it was a weird story how I ended up working for Core.
Well, that's the thing, because you went from Nottingham, then, you know, mm-hmm. down the road to Derby, to Core Design. Mm-hmm. I mean, so what happened there then? How did you get the job there? Yeah, and why did you want to work in the video game sector?
Well, the funny thing is I didn't want to work in video games.
Right.
but I was definitely looking for freelance illustration. And I noticed that video games were doing really high quality covers for their games. And so I was at a friend's house in Nottingham who was a big Amiga geek. He was really into it, and he had piles of magazines in his flat. And one of them was something like Amiga Power or whatever, and it had a really cool illustration of Thunderhawk by Core. So I literally just looked up their address and gave them a call and said, can I send you my stuff? And they said, yeah, sure, why don't you just come in? And I interviewed with them, and it was... to do a bunch of illustrations for this game they were making, and they wanted 2D hand-painted backgrounds that they would then scan in and put in the game, like all the old-school point-and-click adventure games were doing, you know, Sierra, LucasArts, and so on. So they were sort of joining that bandwagon. And I said, sure, you know, love to, but I just wanted to do freelance. And they threatened me. They said, do you really want us to tell your landlord you turned down a full-time job? So To this day, I don't know how serious they were. I think they were joking, but they delivered it in such a dry, threatening way, I capitulated. So I took the job, but I didn't move to Derby. I had a really miserable commute on the bus, getting up at like 6 a.m. in pitch black on Derby Road, getting the bus in front of the Savoy Cinema there. And then in winter when it was freezing, you know, I'd get off at the bus station in Derby and there was another 20-minute walk in the ice and snow to the office, which wasn't much fun, but the job made it worth it.
Well, what was it like with the kind of limitations that were presented on the Amiga and trying to display, you know, something of high quality with that kind of resolution?
Well, that's one of the reasons I didn't want to work in games, because my aspirations were all towards the high end of stuff. You know, I mentioned I love Star Wars and my illustrations were as detailed as possible. And so looking at games, it was frustrating to see those visual limitations. And so that was the first challenge, was scanning in my art and then seeing how crazy low resolution it had to be crunched down to, and then having to go in deep paint, you know, deluxe paint, touch up all the pixels one by one and so on, which initially I found super frustrating, but it was also fascinating to see how cleverly pixel artists were already learning to create really nice art. Again, back to the arcade games, some of them were doing really, really impressive pixel art, especially on some of the top-down shooters and stuff like that. So I did find inspiration in looking at other games and understanding how much you could actually convey quite effectively with just pixel art. So it was a sort of learned aesthetic that I grow to sort of appreciate.
Lots of tips and tricks and stuff that, you know, pixel artists were using to display it really well on the CRT. And was that the kind of stuff that you were picking up?
Well, I wasn't doing anything clever myself. I was just sort of brute forcing it, just doing whatever I could to tweak and hand paint the pixels in to enhance it and make it look good, given the time I had, which wasn't always a lot of time. So it was as much as I could get done to meet the deadlines, you know. But in the meantime, Gary was the smart guy who did his clever split palette tech, where he basically figured out how to create a separate palette on each line. So that way we could achieve approximately a sort of 256 color palette. That was a bit hit and miss. Sometimes his conversion process sort of mangled the images a bit, and I would have to go in, touch up some of the lines where it ran out of colors and couldn't find a decent color to put in there, basically. So I would have to touch it up afterwards by hand. But that was the only clever technique, which was very clever, but other than that, it was more or less just a lot of man hours just hand tweaking it, really.
Well, one game that really used that to great effect, I mean, you talked about the, you know, the point and click adventure games, mm-hmm. the core were doing, I mean, Universe, which I always loved that game as a kid. You play a kid called Boris Verne, who I remember, I think he was in Ashby de la Zouche.
That's right.
I think it was set in, which is here in the East Midlands, and he had to ride his bike through the snow, maybe inspired by your walks.
I guess it must have
been. Station.
Yeah, there were a few little inside references for sure. Ashby de la Zouche was one of them, yeah.
I mean, it was a very atmospheric game, and I mean, what kind of influences were you taking for that and the design of the game and the look of it? Because, I mean, when I saw that running on an Amiga 500 with those graphics, I mean, it was jaw-droppingly beautiful.
Yeah, I'm very proud of what I did for both Enchantia and Universe. And in terms of Enchantia, I've got a funny little story about that one, because Yahtzee is a sort of bit of a mini celebrity online who reviews games. He did a review of Enchantia and completely ripped it to pieces, as he usually does. But he said, firstly, which was interesting, it was the first Amiga game he ever played, which I like that idea. But then he was wondering about who this artist was, because they said they started to get the impression playing through it that it was so random. But the only good thing was the backgrounds. And they said that they think they just found a bunch of great art, great background art, and just made up stuff to fit in each image.
And built a game around the art.
Yeah, exactly. Which kind of isn't too far off of the truth in a way. by the end, he looked at the credits and saw my name and said, oh, there's some guy in a cabin in Sweden or something. And they just commissioned a whole lot of paintings and then made up the game, which I think was hilarious. But back to Universe, what that was actually was the plan was to make a sequel, Enchantia 2, but one of the team wasn't going to be on it. So I think for some reason they chose not to. So they were open to new ideas for a sequel in the same kind of vein. And I'd written a movie pitch idea that I'd actually, in my naive, innocent self, I'd tried to send to Hollywood producers. So Gary Kurtz was the producer of Star Wars, and he was based in Britain. And I sent him my pitch package of my story and illustrations and stuff for this big, silly, ambitious sci-fi epic, which was completely inspired by Star Wars. And I sent it to a few others. I sent it to James Cameron and John Carpenter. And it was so funny because at one point, the agency I sent it to allowed me to call them. So I was sort of in a phone box again on Derby Road, middle of the night or whatever it was, time in LA. And I was literally pound coins into this phone box. I didn't have a cell phone at the time, and trying to talk to this agency in LA. And one of them actually said, is that Roger Moore? I said, no, Rolf Moore. And all I got was, you know, no, we can't accept unsolicited submissions. But I did get a note that apparently James Cameron liked my painting, which I included of the Colossus, which ended up in Universe. So basically, all I did was adapted that story to make it work along the same format. So I didn't have a boy that got transplanted to another universe. I just had a big sort of space opera story. So I adapted it to fit the same mold as Enchantia, about an ordinary kid from our world being transported into another universe. But instead of a fantasy universe, it was now a science fiction universe. So that's how that came about. And so some of the imagery and paintings I already done, I either just literally repurposed one-to-one for that game, or just adapted and created new designs for the world and the characters and so on. And I worked closely with another guy, a designer, Jim Bottomley Mason, who's really great at helping develop the story a bit more and fleshing out a lot of the dialogue. And he brought a lot of the humor to it. I hadn't really conceived it with much humor, but he added a lot of that spice to the dialogue, which I think in the end helped quite a bit.
Well, the cover art for The Curse of Enchantia was absolutely stunning. Did you find like it helped drive sales quite well and interest?
Well, the boss, Jeremy, was really big on that. He definitely thought that was super important, and he had very high standards for the cover art. So he had his one or two go-to illustrators who would do sort of high quality airbrush illustrations. So, you know, he was quite a perfectionist in a way, and he really wanted a high standard. So I delivered what I could. And the funny thing was, he nitpicked the eyelashes of all things on that painting. He didn't like the eyelashes the way I'd done them, so I think I tweaked them a little bit, but I think that was his only gripe. So yes, I would say the cover art was absolutely important, and it applies to so many things. It applies to book covers, comics, anything, that the cover art, and that like I said, that's what I tried to become initially, was a cover artist as a career. And I've always found it perhaps the most important thing when it comes to purchasing anything. You know, you pick up that cover because it compels you and it draws you to it, and then you're just hoping the book or the comic or the movie or the game delivers on the promise of the cover.
Well, when we talk around that era, I mean, Universe came out in 94, and you know, around that time, kind of bubbling under, the you know, the PlayStation was about to be released in Japan that year, and you know, there's a massive shift in gaming. Suddenly it felt like, you know, 12 months later the entire world went 3D. So I mean, were you preparing for that, and did you see it coming? And how important was learning 3D and, you know, systems like, you know, Silicon Graphics workstations? How did you kind of move into that, and did you see that as really important at the time?
Yes, I knew that was going to be super important. So I mentioned that early on I'd seen early development of computer graphics. So even when I went, when I was choosing my university course, I was torn between industrial design or architecture, but I also knew computer graphics was going to be the thing. So I bought a book on computer graphics, and it had stuff about, you know, how to code computer graphics and so on. And it was so early that there was no real distinction between what became the programmers and the artists in graphics at the time. It was all one and the same thing. So even while I was at university, I would jump on a BBC computer and try to literally learn BASIC and type in the coordinates to make it draw a cube and stuff like that. I try to figure out my own little perspective equations, you know. It was absolute nonsense, but it was me attempting to get ahead on that. And my dad had a home computer as well, and I think he probably had something like Microsoft Paint, so I would try to learn how to paint pixel art on there. I knew it was going to be huge. In fact, I thought on an Amiga you would be able to make your own movies in the fairly near future, which was sort of, in a way, completely wrong, and yet in a way it was right, because the show Babylon 5 was rendered on the high-end Amigas, what were called Amiga toasters.
So, the video tester, yeah.
That's right. So I knew it was coming for sure. So I did try to learn 3D. I dabbled a teeny bit while I was at Core. And if you remember, on Universe, we did the first couple of scenes that were rendered in 3D. But one of our other guys, Stu Atkinson, rendered one of the scenes in, I think it was, the program was Real 3D. We had different ones. We did have Wavefront as well while we were there. And then when I went to Sony, I that was the first time I properly learned 3D on Softimage.
Well, during this time as well, you were doing stuff with Hasbro. And how did that develop, and how did you get into the kind of area of doing concepts?
Yeah, I think that was through my comic connections. So there was an agency called CIA, not that agency, but a different one.
Men in black suits turned
yeah,
up.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. They were Creative Interests Agency, which is a play on the Hollywood agency, Creative Artists Agency. And a lot of their clients were comic artists, but they were using comic artists to do freelance illustration and concept designs. So they were the ones who hooked me up with Hasbro. And I was still in England doing sketches for what they called at the time special projects. So in Rhode Island, Hasbro had a division that were focusing on movie pitches, and they called them special projects. So I was just in my flat in London sketching and then faxing the sketches over, and they would just send feedback and so on. So that was really cool. In a way, nothing to do with games. It was a sideline that I was still interested in pursuing, being an illustrator or designer. And I've always loved the idea of designing for toys, so that was great.
We did some really interesting stuff around that time. There was a concept that you worked on, Tim Burton's Superman Lives. So what kind of happened with that project? And wasn't it Nick Cage who's meant to play Superman? What did you think of that?
It is that very same project that is now sort of the stuff of legend in a way. And it was the second project I worked on for Hasbro. And as it turned out, yeah, it was the Kevin Smith script that they were developing at the time, which I didn't really find out too much about until years later. In fact, you can go on YouTube and watch a hilarious talk by Kevin Smith of how he landed that job and the crazy stories of the producer, John Peters, who was Barbra Streisand's hairdresser. You have to watch that if you get a chance. And the reason it speaks to me is because when I was doing some of these concepts for Hasbro, they were talking about different actors, including Jim Carrey or Gary Oldman to play Brainiac. So it was interesting to get insight into the process of how, when Hasbro were collaborating with the movie studio, they even had a bit of a say on, you know, even casting as well as story and stuff like that, which surprised me. But the funny thing was they made me do various versions of a sort of biomechanical spider as part of the Brainiac's alien technology that was transforming and stuff like that. Well, years later, I watched the Kevin Smith video and he said that John Peters, the producer, had a weird obsession with a giant spider. So he wanted to see a giant spider. And that's why Kevin Smith put it in the script. And he kept saying, why? Why do you want a giant spider? And the producer said, well, they're just the most dangerous, you know, fierce creature there is. Well, he never got the giant spider in Superman Lives, but he did in the film Wild Wild West with, you know, Will Smith. That movie, and there was a giant steampunk mechanical spider, so he got it in the end.
Oh, anyway. If our listeners want to hear more about Superman Lives, there's The Death of Superman Lives, What Happened, which was a documentary that came out.
Yeah, which is excellent. And actually, I was supposed to be on that, and the guy making it contacted me, and for some reason, we couldn't figure out a decent video method. You know, we didn't it might have been pre-Zoom, but whatever happened, we couldn't figure out a decent quality way of doing it, so I missed out on that one, unfortunately. Yeah,
well, you mentioned Sony Signosis as well. How did you get involved there, and kind of, you know, Signosis moving from being an independent studio into Sony, what was the kind of setup like there?
I first interviewed with a guy, Jeff Bramfitt, who was an art director at Signosis. So he was from up north, you know, Liverpool. And then when I got started at Sony in London, they were still in they still had Sony Signosis on one floor and Sony Computer Entertainment on the floor above. So for 3 months, I trained with the Signosis artists on Softimage. And as you remember, this was all the big thing when Sony had bought all these Silicon Graphics workstations. So it was all sort of at the time the cutting edge of high-end visuals for video games. So it was very exciting. And when I was with the Signosis team, they were working on a Spawn game, which was all this high-end pre-rendered stuff, which was going to be a fighting game, a bit like how sort of Killer Instinct looked, and or Mortal Kombat, that sort of style. Not digitized from real actors, but high-end rendering. So that was pretty nice to be among those super talented artists. And then, 3 months later, I moved up to work for Sony Computer Entertainment, and I was hired by Phil Harrison, who at the time was just this young sort of newcomer, tall young guy in his early 20s, and then he became head of Sony Worldwide and Microsoft and Google, and became this sort of international superstar. But
was so it bizarre. Really good to kind of, you know, get your hands on those Silicon Graphics machines and
Like that
kind of what stuff were you creating or playing about with?
Well, one of the first things I did actually was a little render of the PlayStation itself. So the PS1, the PlayStation, they were doing a launch video. So I modeled and rendered that in Softimage, and I had a little animated sequence of you flying towards a PlayStation, and then the lid would open up and all this glowing light would come out, and then you'd plunge inside and it would transition you down into sort of cyberspace, like Tron kind of idea, as if we were going inside the powerful, you know, processing power of the PlayStation 1, and it would have this vast city of possibilities in there. So that was my very first, you know, indulgence in that space. So that was really fun to do that. And then we were tinkering with other projects. One of them was a cyberspace game called Cyberjet, and then another one was Porsche Challenge, which is the one I officially worked on that got released. And there were other couple of projects that never saw the light of day, you know.
And apparently you came up with the name Killzone as well. Was that which was somehow connected with Mean Arenas, which was a small fun title that I remember playing on the Amiga.
Well, yeah, there were a couple of projects that were in development. One of them, like I mentioned, was Cyberjack. Which was a cyberspace game, like you're flying ship around like Descent kind of thing. And we, our writer on that actually was George Stone, who was the creator of Max Headroom. He wrote the initial story and pilot and even came up with the name Max Headroom. So he was a really, really clever and funny guy. So he was writing the story. But anyway, I digress. The other game prototype we were trying to get off the ground was with the same producer, Martin Oldtimes. And he had this idea for a four-player beat 'em up. So we'd seen Tekken and so on, and we thought it'd be fun to have tag teams and, you know, fight with four characters. So we were just playing around with ideas at the time, and he asked us to write a short list of names. So me and Martin just wrote down a list of ideas for names. And one of my ideas was Killzone, which is sort of influenced by the cheesy sort of Marvel UK comics at the time. And it was kind of not even a very serious suggestion, but I just threw it in there. And then what happened was I left Sony, but Martin got assigned to the guerrilla team that were making this FPS, this sort of futuristic hard sci-fi first-person shooter. They had a name in mind for themselves, but Sony threw out a few ideas, and Martin still had Killzone in his list of ideas. And he proposed Killzone, and Sony liked it. Guerrilla didn't, but Sony went with Killzone. So that's how I accidentally named Killzone, which is really
bizarre. I'm guessing you don't get royalties for the name on the recent titles,
I don't think so.
Well, I mean, after your time at Sony Signosis, I mean, you ended up joining DreamWorks Interactive, obviously legendary company. I mean, why did you change and end up joining DreamWorks then? How did that journey happen?
Well, I was still looking around. I was sort of eager to maybe work in the US and work, you know, in Los Angeles and among Hollywood people. I'd still had a big interest in sci-fi movies and, you know, Star Wars and all the rest of it. So, and I loved Spielberg movies. And what happened was I was at a big trade show, ECTS, which was like the British version of E3. And Sony had the entire one end of the hall occupied with their huge logo and everything. So our presence was there on one half of the entire hall. And then right in front of them to the left was a little DreamWorks booth. So and at the time I was still lugging my physical portfolio around. It wasn't all digital at the time. So I physically walked in with my portfolio under my arm right in front of the Sony stand and went into a little back room and talked to DreamWorks, and there was this guy there. Actually, there was a bit of a connection, which I keep forgetting, that a guy who was at DreamWorks called Kyle had previously done some work with Virgin Interactive, who were publishers for some of Core's games. So there was a bit of a little connection there. And he absolutely loved my portfolio and immediately put me in touch with the art director, or several art directors over at DreamWorks. So they then flew me over for an interview, and I met the various teams, and they said, which team do you want to work with? And I was most impressed by what they were doing on Trespasser, which is this crazy ambitious project, you know, directly tied into a Spielberg film. I absolutely loved Jurassic Park, and the renders they were doing, these target renders, were just so mind-blowing. It was like, how can I not want to be on this project? So,
well, tell us a bit about working on that, because, I mean, it was a really groundbreaking title, Trespasser, and it was like it was a CD-ROM sequel to Jurassic Park Lost World, yeah?
Yes, that's what they billed it as, a digital sequel to Jurassic Park Lost World, and it was very ambitious, as you know. I was even skeptical at the time. I thought, I don't quite see how you're going to be able to pull this off. But I trusted them, and they talked a big talk. And we had Seamus Blackley heading up the team, who'd done Flight Unlimited for Looking Glass, and he brought some of his team with him. They had incredibly talented programmers and engineers and artists. It was the most mind-bogglingly talented team I would have come across by that point. And just the environment, of course, being flown over to LA, all of it was just a mind-boggling experience. Even just from when I was in my little flat in London and this huge articulated lorry pulled into our court to take my stuff and my belongings were just put in the back corner of this enormous truck, you know, to transport my stuff over there, and being put up in these nice sort of apartments by the ocean, right near Venice Beach by the ocean. The entire experience was just a trip, and just physically walking around the DreamWorks studios, it felt surreal, you know. And then, you know, seeing Spielberg walk down the corridor, and yeah, it was just sort of really surreal experience.
Sounds like just going into a totally different kind of insane world, really.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was, yeah, you can imagine. It was such a sort of strange transformation, you know.
Quite a change from Nottingham and Derby.
Yeah, exactly. The bus trip, you know, in the snow and all that, and now sort of hanging out in Hollywood. Yeah, really weird.
Well, you ended up doing some titles for Nova Logic as well, and Touchy on the Fringe was quite a good game for the PC. I remember it had a voice of Bruce Campbell.
That's right, yeah.
In that game. What was it like kind of returning to the sci-fi genre and, you know, doing those like 3D space models?
It's great, of course. I mean, that's why I took the job eagerly. Well, although, to be honest, Nova Logic were more known for their military games. So they did things like Delta Force and the helicopter game Comanche. So they really only... for some reason, they only tried the sci-fi game once, and it was mainly because of the a lot of the game studios in those days were sort of led by individuals who just promoted their own project ideas. There was a guy called Randy, and that was his whole baby, the Tachyon game. So the studio, you know, decided to greenlight his project, so it was his baby, and so I was happy to work on that, and it was great to use 3D Studio Max to model the ships and stuff, as well as concepting nearly all the ships in the whole game. Built the space station that is on the cover as well. And the thing is, everything was so low poly. Someone with my mediocre modeling skills was able to at least do first pass models. I didn't do any of the final in-game models.
Because I was wondering, because it was quite multiplayer, that title, and I was wondering, were there any considerations needed for, like, you know, people with bandwidth issues, yeah, and stuff like that?
Well, exactly. Yeah, that's what it was all about. Everything had to be optimal, super optimized. But I'd come from, my whole career was spent dealing with heavy optimizing of assets and so on. So I was already fairly well trained to think along those lines, and I was already being very economical with the way I would design ships to have them naturally low poly in the way their geometry was conceived. So, yeah, I was already kind of in that mindset by then.
Well, working with Neversoft, I mean, obviously Tony Hawk's was a really, really strong brand there. And you worked on Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 4, I mean. Mm. And obviously they were such big games and they were selling such big volumes. I mean, was there a lot of pressure to kind of improve the standard every time and really make the games look better?
Yeah, for sure. They were very, very hardcore. I think I sort of took that as an interim job because it wasn't something I was super... I didn't have a... You know, I was still more in the sci-fi and fantasy world in my tastes, so I didn't have any plans to pursue that as a career. So I didn't stay there long. But yeah, they were a very intense team who were all about performance and super high quality. They just had their own unique work methods, such as the designer themselves would actually build the maps, and then the artist's job was more or less just texturing and skinning and fleshing out what was already built for them. So in a way, that was not as exciting for a designer like me who wants to design the visual environment from scratch. So it was sort of less creative in that sense. Sure.
Well, talking of creative, Ratchet and Clank was just visually absolutely stunning. I remember when I first saw it, my jaw hit the floor, and that was that real step up in like computer power and space as well. What was it like kind of joining Insomniac and getting your hands on those games.
Yeah, I mean, that was super exciting. You know, they already had a big reputation even since I was at DreamWorks when Spyro came out. Everybody was singing their praises. Who's this new team? You know, Insomniac, they're really good. And they had it all. You know, they had really good performance and optimization, really good gameplay, really nice graphics. So they were sort of considered, you know, definitely superstars already by that time. So it was really cool to join their team. And like Neversoft, they were in a similar way, very hardcore, very intense. But I think they had a little bit better sense of organizational efficiency. One of the most impressive things was just the way they ran their company at every level, super organized. And I think that's why they were able to punch above their weight, because they were so clever at managing tasks and schedules and manpower, and also making choices efficiently. Don't waste too much time iterating and trying to get something to work if it's not really going to be worth it. You know, just if it's not worth it, just cut it and focus on the main elements that are going to make this game good. And that sense of discipline, I think, paid off in those days. So it was a very tightly run ship. There was a lot of pressure and there was a lot of crunch, but the people were so good and talented. It felt worth it. So yeah, the first thing I touched was the right at the end of the first Ratchet and Clank game. And I just painted some clouds for the sky in level 16. So, but the rest, yeah, I worked on all of them until Crack in Time on PlayStation 3.
I was going to say, you've worked on a lot of Ratchet and Clank titles. I mean, what was your kind of favorite part of that? Any memories that stand out?
My favorite parts were usually the ideation phase. So when it was, you would just have very brief description of the level and you know, maps of how the layout would be, and then you get to get in there and flesh it out and design it. That was always my favorite part. And those design ideas got more and more exciting as it progressed. So by the time of Cracking Time, I was coming up with some really imaginative, interesting ideas for environments that some of those never saw the light of day, but that was very exciting. In terms of sort of gratifying results, for me the favorite end result was probably Up Your Arsenal, because of the sense of completion of that game and then playing it was so fun. That whole experience was very rewarding.
Well, here's a question: have you worked on any cancelled titles that we might not have heard of before?
Yeah, quite a few actually. Some I probably can't talk about, but there are some I think it's okay to talk about. Some is sort of publicly known. I think people do know that Enchantia, for example, was going to have a sequel, and I mentioned that earlier, and that became something else. And then the two I already mentioned at Sony were Cyberjack and Mean Arenas. But at DreamWorks, there was one called Exile, which was this hugely ambitious science fiction game that the producer there was developing, and he put so much time and thought into it, and we had an entire conference room with the walls covered in beautiful concept art. He'd had multiple really talented concept artists working on, you know, this project, and I did a bit of work for it, which was really cool. It was all going to be quote-unquote next-gen at the time, and in a way, they just sort of treated it like, oh, next gen, literally anything's going to be possible. They had no sort of sense of realism about it. It was just going to be an increment in technology. It wasn't just suddenly going to be instant photorealism. But that happened multiple generations. There were so many times that we went through the same thing of, oh, it's going to be totally photoreal next generation. Oh, really? We're still not even there. There is no photoreal game that exists. But they thought it was going to be like that back in the, you know, 90s or whatever. So funny. Yeah, that never saw the light of day. And the guy moved over to DreamWorks Animation and worked on Sinbad. So he just dropped the ball and moved on. There's another one I worked on, which was a Lunar Racer. Briefly worked at a little startup company, and they had a bit of a cross promotion with NASA. So they were going to do this racing game set on the moon. That was a lot of fun. And then when I was in between jobs in when I was in Austin, Texas, I had a little startup company called Microraptor Games, and we pitched a few different projects, one of which came very close to getting greenlit by Sony and Microsoft, but never quite saw the light of day. Can't really talk much about that, but that would have been a really cool game. And then the other one, which is much better known, was Battle Cry. So again, in Austin, ZeniMax had spun up a studio called Battle Cry Studios to make a game called Battle Cry. And it was a multiplayer arena-based game, and it was designed by Viktor Antonov, who's a really, really talented production designer who was responsible for Half-Life 2 and the whole, how he conceived City 17, the whole environment. And he was the kind of whole inspiration for the Dishonored franchise, that whole look. That's his wheelhouse, is that sort of retro steampunk slash sort of Victorian colonial era. He loves all of that style. And it was that kind of, he'd done an art book about a bridge set in that world. And that's what the inspiration for this game was based on, at least at a visual level. And the design of these alternate history sort of colonial powers all doing battle in these sort of arranged arenas that would just be set up in different towns. So they'd take over the center of a town and build their arenas temporarily, have a fight, and then move on. And that's how they settled disputes between the powers. So that was really a lot of fun to design.
I mean, you kind of touched on there, I mean, you know, about the change in console generations and kind of the expectations as well. And I mean, I'd say in terms of, you know, the leaps in console technology, that decade from the mid-90s when you went from the, you know, the PS1, then to the PS2 in the early 2000s, to kind of the HD generation, the PlayStation 3. And I know you're working on launch titles for the PS3, like Resistance Fall of Man. Mm. I mean, did it kind of feel like, you know, those graphical jumps, did they feel really big? And how did you take advantage of those?
I think you're right that for me, the PS3 has always felt like the biggest jump out of all of them. And yeah, we were right on the cutting edge with Resistance. That was actually SKU number one. So that was the number one released title by Sony on their new platform. And that's when it felt really like we were right there working so closely with Sony, and our engineers were over there in Japan actually helping design the hardware for the console. And actually, Insomniac was a bit overlooked at the time because everybody thought of Naughty Dog as the tech people, and nobody knew how much muscle we had in our technology group at Insomniac, and how intimately we were working with that group. They called it the ICE team, where they were sharing technology with the Sony Cambridge as well and Guerrilla. And we were completely integral, or at least our engineering team were. So to be in that space, seeing it firsthand, was super exciting. And all the new capabilities we were designing for Resistance. In fact, early on, that was going to be set in World War One, but it shifted a bit because they didn't feel the weaponry would be balanced enough with that sort of primitive sort of technology against aliens. So they shifted it to World War II period. And we focused so much on the sort of gameplay and the processing power that was sort of going on under the hood to do an open world with tight sort of gameplay running at 60 frames a second. It maybe impacted us a little bit on the visual presentation side, which was considered a bit lackluster by the public. Whereas we went out against Gears of War at the same time, who were really focusing on the visuals a lot more, as well as having an innovation with the third person style of game. So they had it all going for them, but theirs was buggy and it had so much problems with frame rate and all sorts of glitching, but the public didn't care. They enjoyed the game so much. They forgave all the bugginess, and we suffered a bit in terms of reviews by contrast, which was kind of annoying to me because I felt people didn't quite appreciate how much we'd sort of innovated in that game and our technology. But it's okay. I'm still very proud of that. And the second one as well, Resistance 2. They're really impressive games.
You also worked on some great brands, which like Halo and Twisted Metal. And I was thinking, you know, what was the approach of kind of making them look improved and updated without losing that kind of relation to the original concept and, you know, not alienating the fan base.
Hmm. Well, I didn't have much involvement with Twisted Metal at all. That was when I was working for a sort of an outsourcing group in a way for Sony. They have a group called VASG in San Diego, and they hire freelancers. So I only did a bit of concept work for a cinematic for that game. So I had very, very little input on that.
Okay.
So that was just nice to be able to put it on my resume because it's a cool game, you know, and it was nice. The conception of that cinematic was really cool. But Halo, I had a lot more insight into working with Certain Affinity, and we were sort of co-developers with 343. They were running the show, and we worked closely with their art directors and so on. At the time, the art director for 343 was Kenneth Scott, who'd come off of Doom and Rage from id Software. And he is a really, really, really talented artist and art director. So he was the main influence on the visual side. And he did a lot of rethinking of the armor suits. And he developed the architecture of the Forerunners quite deeply. So we worked closely with them in terms of the art style. And I think it was relatively easy to maintain consistency with the visual language that had been established. We also had a really good art director on our end, Mark Anderson, who previously worked on God of War. So I think we had it really covered. We had such a strong art team at Certain Affinity and such good art direction on 343's end that it was relatively easy to just focus on upping the ante, you know, just really pushing the visual quality across the board and having some freedom to innovate a little bit within certain boundaries. I was in some of the multiplayer maps, I was pushing the visual style a bit more away from the clunky old sort of 80s angular and 45 degree stuff and pushing towards a bit of a sleeker, more modern take on science fiction. And they were quite open and receptive to some of our ideas. So that was really rewarding working on that. I think if anything, some would argue they dropped a ball more on the game design side where they deviated a bit from a lot of the successful formulas they'd figured out in Halo 3, which some people still would say played a lot better than Halo 4. I enjoyed playing Halo 4, but it was somewhat of a linear experience compared to Halo 3, I think.
Beautiful looking game as well, though.
Not to brag, but yeah, I think it was absolutely beautiful. I mean, the talent on 343's end as well. They had incredible concept artists, not to mention Dylan Cole, who's now a superstar working on the Avatar movies. He got nominated for an Oscar for the production design along with Ben Proctor. And I happen to work with them now at Disney on the Avatar games. So yeah, it's funny how some things come full circle in a way.
Well, that is your current role. I mean, let's kind of move to the current day. I mean, your lead concept artist at Walt Disney Studios. I mean, how did you end up working there? And I mean, you're working on stuff like Tron and Aliens and Guardians of the Galaxy. That must be incredible.
Yeah, you're listing my favorite IPs, my favorite movies and stuff. So it is a bit of a dream, you know, situation to have landed in. It's because I went to Telltale, worked on Guardians of the Galaxy and Batman there, and then I went to 2K on the Bioshock 4 team, you know, for Cloud Chamber, which is a new studio that spun up. So having all that stuff on my resume means you start to get headhunted. So Disney actually reached out to me, and everything they described sounded so cool, I couldn't really turn it down. I'd also previously worked at Disney, of course, on Epic Mickey when I was in Austin. So Warren Spector had that studio.
Legendary developer, Warren Spector as well.
So he was great to work with. And the project itself was very challenging. But one of the reasons they hired me was because of what I was doing at Insomniac on the PS3 Ratchet and Clank games, which our whole objective was to make them try and look like Pixar movies. And that's exactly what Junction Point wanted to try and achieve with Epic Mickey. They wanted to blend the sort of platforming action gaming of Ratchet and Clank with the Pixar look. So that's why they hired me to art direct Epic Mickey. Well, technically my title was visual development director. And so I was pretty significant in figuring out the whole look of that game after they'd done earlier versions, which were much more ambitious with these crazy, huge environments that couldn't really be achieved on the current consoles of the time. And so I had to help figure out how to sort of scope it down a bit and make it feasible.
Well,
that was
Rolf,
all very fun.
Well, Rolf, before we finish, what are you currently working on and what can you kind of talk about?
Well, for Disney, I obviously can't say much, but I can say, you know, I've been helping out on some of those IPs, so Avatar, Tron, and Aliens. As far as my own projects, I'm also working on a couple of short film projects, as well as my own graphic novel called Heonarch, which I've been I'm way behind on, but I tinker away at it when I can. And one day, maybe I'll release that as a graphic novel in some form. It might be digital online, not necessarily print, or could be both, of course.
Well, Rolf, it's been absolutely amazing. I can't believe how much we crammed into that hour. You know, your career over the last 30-odd years has just been incredible. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing some of your memories with us, and best of luck with the future.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. And great fun. Thanks a lot.